Looks like you're starting to crack under the pressure, they'll pull you out. Word gets around that I'm telling fairy tales about things I've seen. They'll have me on psychiatric disability by tomorrow. He turned to go. Wait, I said. I touched his arm lightly. I didn't grab him. You don't go unexpectedly grabbing former Marines if you want your fingers to stay in the same shape. Look, Mr. Lamar, I just want to hear about it. I'm not going to repeat it to anyone. I'm not a reporter or... He paused. You're the wizard, he said. Saw you on Larry Fowler once. People say you're crazy. Yeah, I said. So it isn't as if they'd believe me, even if I did talk about you, which I won't. You're the one they arrested in the nursery a few years back, he said. You broke in during a blackout. They found you in the middle of a wrecked room with all those babies. I took a deep breath. Yeah. Lamar was silent for a second. Then he said, You know that the year before, the SIDS rate there was the highest in the nation? They averaged one case every 10 days. No one could explain it. I didn't know that, I said. Since they arrested you there, they haven't lost one, he said. He turned back to me. You did something. Yeah. Do you like ghost stories? He snorted out a breath through his nose. I don't like any of this crap, man. Why do you want me to tell you what I saw? Because what you know might help me keep more people from getting hurt. He nodded, frowning. All right, he said after a moment. But I'm saying this right now. You understand me? I'm not going to say this again, to anyone. Only reason I'll tell you is that you helped those babies. I nodded. He sat down on the edge of the gurney. We got the call around midnight, headed over to Wacker. The cops were there already. Found this guy on the street, all busted up, 2 hits in the chest and 2 in the abdomen. He was bleeding bad. I nodded, listening. We tried to stabilize him. But there wasn't much point to it. Simmons and me both knew that. But we tried. It's what you do, you know. He was awake for it, scared as hell, screaming some. Kept begging us not to let him die. Said he had a little girl to look after. What happened? He died, Lamar said, his voice flat. I've seen it before. Here in town, in action while I was in the Corps. You get to where you can recognize death when it comes knocking. He rubbed his large, rather slender hands together. We tried to resuscitate, but he was gone. That's when it happened. Go on. This woman shows up. I don't know from where. We just looked up, and she was standing over us, looking down. I leaned forward. What did she look like? I don't know, Lamar answered. She was, like wearing this costume, right? Like those people at Renaissance fairs. Big old black robe with a hood over her head. I didn't see much of her face, just her chin and her throat. She was white. What did you do? I figured she was a nut. You get them a lot this time of year. Or maybe going to a costume party or something. Hell, it's almost Halloween. She looks at me and tells me to back up and let her help him. How many women in a black hooded robe could have been running around town last night? Kumori. That would have been maybe 45 minutes or an hour before I saw her at Box. Lamar peered at my face. You know her, he said. Not personally, but yeah. What did she do? His face grew more remote. She knelt down over him, like straddling the stretcher. Then she leaned down. The robe and the hood fell over them both, right? Like I couldn't see what she was doing. He licked his lips. And it got cold. I mean, ice started forming on the sidewalk and the stretcher and on our truck. I swear to you it happened. I believe it, I said. And the victim all of a sudden starts coughing, trying to scream. I mean, it wasn't like the wounds were gone, but I don't know how to describe it. He was holding on. His face twisted with a sickened expression. He was in agony, and he was stable. It was like he wasn't being allowed to die. So the woman stands up, she tells us we've got less than an hour to save him, and then she's gone. Like poof, gone. Like she was all in my imagination. I shook my head. Then, we get him brought in. The docs patched him up and got fresh blood into him. He passed out about an hour later, but he made it. Lamar was silent for a long moment. That couldn't have happened, he said then. I mean, I've seen people pull through some bad stuff, but not like that. He should have been dead. Everything I know tells me so. But he kept going. Sometimes miracles happen, I said quietly. He shuddered. This wasn't a miracle. There wasn't any angel choir singing. My skin tried to crawl away and hide. He shook his head. I don't want to think about it. What about your partner? I asked. He drank himself under the table 20 minutes after our shift ended. Hell, only reason I wasn't with him was that I was teaching a CPR class this morning. He looked at me. That help? It might, I said. Thank you. Sure. What are you going to do now? I asked. Gonna go find my own table. Lamar stood up and said, Good luck, man. Thanks. The big man left, and while I got my prescriptions and filled out the last forms, I thought about what he'd had to say. I got the prescriptions filled at the hospital pharmacy, called a cab, and told him to take me to Mike's to pick up the Blue Beetle. I sat in the back seat with my eyes closed and thought about what I'd learned. Kumori had saved the gunshot victim's life. If everything Lamar had said was accurate, it meant that she had gone out of her way to do it. And whatever she'd done, it had been an extremely difficult working to leave a mystic impression as intense as it did. That might explain why Kumori had done very little during the altercation with Cowell. I had expected her to be nearly as strong as her partner, but when she tried to take the book from me, her power hadn't been stronger than my own muscles and limbs. But the Kemmler Alumni Association was in town with some vicious competition in mind. Why would Kumori have expended her strength for a stranger rather than saving it for battling rival necromancers? Could the shooting victim have been important to her plans in some way? It didn't track. The victim was just one more thug for the outfit, and he certainly wasn't going to be doing anything useful from his bed in intensive care. I had to consider the possibility that she had been trying to do the right thing, using her power to help someone in dire need. The thought made me uncomfortable as hell. I knew that the necromancers I'd met were deadly dangerous, and that if I wanted to survive a conflict with them, I would have to be ready to hit them fast and hard and without any doubts. That's easy when the enemy is a frothing, psychotic monster, but Kumori's apparently humanitarian act changed things. It made her a person, and people are a hell of a lot harder for me to think about killing. Even worse, if she'd been acting altruistically, it would mean that the dark energy the necromancers seemed to favor might not be something wholly, inherently evil. It had been used to preserve life, just as the magic I knew could be used either to protect or to destroy. I'd always considered the line between black magic and white to be sharp and clear. But if that dark power could be employed in whatever fashion its wielder chose, that made it no different from my own. Damn it. Investigation was supposed to make me certain of what needed to be done. It was not supposed to confuse me even more. When I opened my eyes, thick clouds had covered the sun and painted the whole world in shades of gray. Chapter 20. It was past the middle of the afternoon by the time I got the Blue Beetle from Mike's and headed back to my apartment. I tried to be wary of possible tales, but by then the local was wearing off and my leg was hurting again. I don't know if you've ever had a serious physical injury, but there's more to it than simply increasing the amount of discomfort. It's tiring. The pain carries with it attacks of bone-deep weariness that makes you want to crawl into a dark hole and hibernate. So, when I say I tried to be wary, what I mean is that I flicked a glance at my rearview mirror a couple of times whenever I had the presence of mind to remember to do so. As long as the bad guys were restricting themselves to driving brightly painted side-panel vans, or maybe nitro-burning funny cars, I was perfectly safe. I got back to my place, disabled the wards, unlocked the door, and slipped inside. Mister came flying down the stairs at my back and thumped companionably against my legs. I all but screamed. "Stupid cat," I snarled. Mister wound around my legs in a pleased fashion, unconcerned with my opinion of him. I limped inside and locked up behind me. Mouse waited until Mister was bored with me, then shambled over to snuffle at my legs and collect a few scratches behind his ears. "Hey there," Thomas greeted me quietly. He sat in the chair by the fire, several candles lit on the end table beside it. He had a book open, sword and shotgun rested near his hand. He glanced at my leg and rose, his face alarmed. "What happened?" I grimaced, tottered over to the couch, and plopped down on it. "Sticks and stones may break your bones, but Chinese throwing stars get you a dozen stitches." I drew the ghoul's weapon from my pocket by way of illustration and tossed it down on the coffee table. "How's Butters?" "Fine," Thomas said. "Funny little guy. Made an awful racket with that polka thing of his for about half an hour. Babbled for 40 minutes straight and fell asleep eating dinner." I put him on the bed. "He's had a stressful day," I said. "He's a coward," Thomas said. I glared at him and started to snarl something harsh and defensive. He held up a hand and hurried to speak. "Don't take that wrong, Harry. He's smart enough to understand what's happening, and he's smart enough to know that there's not a damn thing he can do about it. He knows the only reason he's alive is that someone else is protecting him. He isn't kidding himself that he's somehow done it because of his own cleverness or skill." Thomas glanced at the door to the bedroom. "He doesn't know how to deal with the fear. It's strangling him." I propped my aching leg up on the coffee table. "Thank you for your professional opinion, counselor." Thomas gave me a level look. "I've seen it before. I know what I'm talking about." "Whatever," I said. "When you were attacked in the morgue last night, he froze, didn't he?" I shrugged one shoulder. "Not everyone is cut out for the battlefield." "But he froze," Thomas said. "You had to scream orders into his ear and haul him around like luggage, right? That doesn't make him a coward. He lets his fear control him. That's what a coward is, Harry." "A lot of people would react the same way," I said. "A lot of people aren't making themselves into excess baggage for my brother," he shot back. "No one does well their first time out," I said. "It isn't an isolated incident," Thomas said. "You told me that when he reported on the corpses taken from Bianca's manor, they locked him up in the nut house." "So?" "So, do you think he got his job back without backing down? Admitting to some shrink that he hadn't really seen what he saw?" Thomas shook his head. "He was afraid to lose his career. He caved." I sat silently. "Doesn't make him a bad person," Thomas said, "but he's a coward. He's either going to get you killed or else freeze at a bad moment and die, and you'll torture yourself over how it's all your fault. If we want to survive, we need to get him somewhere safe, then cut him loose. Better for everyone." I thought about it for a minute. "You might be right," I said, "but if we tell him to rabbit, he's never going to be able to get over the fear. We'll be making it worse for him. He has to face it down." "He doesn't want to." "No," I said, "but he needs to." Thomas looked from me to the fire and nodded. "It's your show." I watched Mouse mosey over to his bucket-sized food bowl. He sat down by it and waited expectantly until Mister prowled over to him. Then he bent down to eat. My cat stalked up to Mouse and promptly swatted him on the muzzle with one paw. Mouse opened his jaws in a doggy grin and walked a couple of steps in the direction Mister had swatted him. Mister regarded Mouse with lordly disdain, then ate part of a single piece of kibble. Then he slapped at the bowl of food, scattering bits over the kitchen floor, and walked away. Once he was done, Mouse padded back over, patiently ate the spilled food, and then resumed munching on the bowl. "Remember when Mouse would slide all the way to the wall when Mister did that?" Thomas asked.
"Yeah."
"Do you think Mister realizes that the dog is about 20 times bigger than he used to be?" Thomas asked. Oh, he realizes it, all right, I said. He just doesn't see how it's relevant. One of these days, Mouse is going to disabuse him of the notion. I shook my head. He won't. Mister made his point when Mouse was tiny. Mouse is the sort to respect tradition. Or he's scared to cross the cat. Thomas's eyes drifted to my bandages, and he nodded at my leg. How bad is it? I can walk. I wouldn't want to go dancing. Is that your next move, dancing? I leaned my head back on the couch and closed my eyes. I'm not sure what to do next. How are you as a sounding board? I can look interested and nod at appropriate moments, he said. Good enough, I said. I told Thomas everything. He listened, taking it all in, and the first thing he said was, You have a date? I opened my eyes and blinked at him. What? Is that so hard to conceive? Well, yeah, he said. Christ, Harry, I thought you were going to spend the rest of your life as a hermit. What? He rolled his eyes. It isn't like you've gone looking for women, Thomas said. I mean, you never hit any clubs, try to get any phone numbers. I figured you just didn't want to. He mulled it over for a minute and then said, Good God, you're shy. I am not, I said. The girl practically had to throw herself into your arms. My sister would laugh herself sick. I glowered at him. You are not a spectacularly helpful sounding board. He stretched out a little and crossed his legs at the ankle. I'm so pretty. It's hard for me to think of myself as intelligent. He pursed his lips. There are two things you need to know. The book, I said, nodding. Yeah. Everyone is hot and bothered over this Earl King thing. You read it? Yeah. And? I raked my fingers through my hair. And nothing. It's a collection of essays about a particular figure of fairy lore called the Earl King. Who is he? He's one of the High She, I said. And he isn't part of winter or summer. He's a wild fae. Powerful? Very, I said. But just how powerful he is varies, depending on who was writing about him. Some of them ranked him among the top fairy nobles. A couple claimed he was on par with one of the fairy queens. What does he do? He's some kind of hunter spirit, I said, associated with all kinds of primal violence. He's apparently one of the beings who can call up and lead the wild hunt. The what? Thomas said. It's a gathering of some of the more predatory beings of faerie, I said. They appear in the autumn and winter, usually along with storms and rough weather. A gathering of black hounds, the size of horses, with glowing red eyes, led by a hunter with the horns of a stag on a black horse. The Earl King? Thomas asked. There are several figures who can lead the hunt, apparently, I said. None of them are particularly friendly. The hunt will kill anything and anyone it runs across. It's major league dangerous. I think I've heard about it, Thomas said. Is it true that you can avoid being hunted by joining them? I shrugged. I don't know. I've never heard of anyone who met the hunt and survived. Could be that they won't hunt what they think of as another predator. Like sharks, Thomas said. It's all about body language. I wouldn't count on nonverbal cues to protect you from the hunt, I said, assuming you ever saw them. It appears maybe only once every 5 or 6 years, and can show up almost anywhere in the world. Is it the hunt you think the Kemlerites are interested in? I'm not sure, I said. I can't think what else it would be. The Earl King has a reputation as a being that preys upon children, or at least one that heralds their deaths. A couple of wizards even peg him as a guardian, who ensures that children's souls aren't harmed or diverted as they depart dying bodies. Sounds like there is a mixed opinion on this Earl King guy. Fairies are like that, I said. They aren't ever quite what they seem to be. It's hard to pin them down. But why would a gang of necromancers be interested in him? Is there anything in the book that makes sense? Not that I saw, I said. There were stories, songs, lectures, accountings, bad sketches and worse poetry about the Earl King, but nothing practical.
Nothing you saw, Thomas said.
Nothing I saw, I confirmed. But these lunatics would hardly be this serious about the book if it wasn't there somewhere.
Do you think it's connected to this Dark Hollow that Corpse Taker was talking about? Thomas asked.
I don't know, I said. What's a Dark Hollow?
We listened to the fire crackle for a minute before Thomas said,
I hate to say this, but maybe you should contact the council.
I grimaced. I know I should, I said. I don't know what they're doing, and these necromancers are strong, Thomas. Stronger than me. I don't think I can take them in a straight fight.
Sounds like a good reason to call for help.
I can't do that, I said. Mavra would torpedo Murphy.
I don't think Murphy would want you to get killed over this, Harry, he pointed out.
And what's going to happen if the council hears that you knew these folk were around and didn't report it to them? They aren't going to be happy.
I know, I said, I know. But at the moment it's my choice, and I'm not going to choose for my friend to get hurt. I can't.
He nodded, as if he'd expected the answer.
Plus, there's one more reason not to call in the council, I said.
Why?
Right now, Cowell, Gravain, and Corpse Taker aren't working together. If I call in the council, it gives them a common enemy and a reason to cooperate.
They have a common enemy, he pointed out.
You.
I laughed, and it came out a little bitter.
They aren't worried about me. Hell, I can't even figure out what's going on.
I rubbed at my eyes.
You said there were two things I needed to know. What's the second thing?
Your car.
Oh, I got it back, I said. It's out front.
No, dummy, Thomas said. Whoever trashed your car did it deliberately. They were trying to tell you something.
It might not even be related to this situation, I said.
He snorted.
Yeah, it just happened now, out of all the times it could have happened.
Whoever was sending the message, it's a little obscure.
You think it's one of the Kemmler crowd?
Why not? He said.
I thought about it for a minute. It doesn't seem like something Gravain would do. I bet he's more like the kind to send undead minions to deliver his messages.
Corpse Taker would send a nightmare or a forced hallucination or something. She's big on the mind magic. Ghouls don't really send messages. They just eat you.
That leaves Cowell, his buddy, and Gravain's buddy with the liver spots.
Yeah, I said. I almost feel like there was something familiar about liver spots, I said. I'm not sure what. I might be grasping at straws.
What about Cowell and Kumori?
I don't know, man, I said. They were just a couple of people in cloaks. I never saw their faces. If I had to guess from the way they talked, I'd bet that they were council.
That would be a very good reason to cover their faces, Thomas agreed.
There's no point in chewing this over and over, I said. I rubbed at my eyes. Bony Tony's numbers mean something. They'll lead to the book somehow. I'm sure of it.
Maybe a locker number, Thomas asked.
Too many digits, I said.
Maybe it's some kind of cipher, substituting letters for numbers.
I raised my eyebrows.
That's a thought.
I dug the folded piece of paper out of my pocket and passed it over to him.
Stay here and work on it. See if you can make any sense out of it.
He accepted the paper.
Now I feel like James Bond, suave and intelligent, breaking all the codes while looking fabulous.
What are you going to do?
I think the Earl King is the key to this, I said. And the Earl King is a fairy.
He lifted his eyebrows.
Meaning?
When you want to know about fairies, I said, it's best to ask a fairy. I'm going to call up my godmother and see if she knows anything.
From what you've told me, isn't that kind of dangerous?
Very, I said.
You're hurt. You should have some backup.
I nodded.
Watch the fort, I said.
Mouse?
The big dog lifted his shaggy head from the floor, ears perked forward, serious eyes on me.
Come on, I told him. We're going for a ride.
Oh, Harry, Thomas said.
Yeah?
Before you go, would you mind if I, helped Butters out by getting his polka contraption loaded up into your trunk?
What, you don't like polka?
Thomas's expression looked strained. Please, Harry, I like the little guy, but come on. I rubbed at my mouth with one hand to cover up the smile.
Sure, probably safest for everyone that way.
Thank you, he said,
and collected the polka suit and brought it up the stairs behind me as I prepared to take a chance on a conversation with one of the more dangerous beings I knew. Chapter 21. Mouse and I took the Beetle out of Chicago proper, following the lake north out of town. For once I wished I had an automatic transmission. Driving stick with only one good hand and one good leg is not fun. In fact, it's the next best thing to impossible, at least for me. I wound up using my wounded leg more than I should have, and the discomfort intensified. I thought about the painkillers in my pocket and then blew them off. I needed to be sharp. When all of this was over, there would be time to muddle my head with codeine. So I drove and swore under my breath at anything that made me change gears, while Mouse rode along in the passenger seat with his head usually sticking out the window. By the time I was far enough from town to start calling out to my godmother, the sun had set, though the cloud-veiled western sky still glowed the color of campfire embers. I pulled off onto a side road that was made of old gravel and stubborn weeds that kept trying to grow up in the road's smooth center. It led down to a little dead end where some kind of construction project never went through. It was a popular spot for local kids to hang out and imbibe illegal substances of one intensity or another, and there were empty beer cans and bottles scattered around in abundance. Mouse and I left the car up on the road and walked maybe 50 yards down through trees and heavy undergrowth to the shore of the lake. At one point on the shore, a little spit of land formed a promontory, only 10 or 12 inches higher than the surface of the water. Wait here, I told Mouse. And the dog sat down at the end of the spit of land, watching me with alert eyes, his ears flicking around at all the little sounds. Then I walked out onto the spit to its end, and a cold wind off the lake swept around me, blowing my coat and threatening my balance. I grimaced and leaned on my staff, out at that point of land where earth and water and sky met one another, and focused my thoughts, blocking out the pain of my leg, my fears, my questions. I gathered together my will, then lifted my face to the wind and called out quietly, Linan Shi, an it please thee, come hither and hold discourse with me. I sent my will, my magic, coursing into the words, and they reverberated with power, echoing from the surface of the lake, repeating themselves in whispers in the swirling wind, vibrating the ground upon which I stood. Then I waited. I could have repeated myself, but my godmother had certainly heard me. If she was going to come, she would. If she wasn't, no amount of repetition was likely to change her mind. The wind blew colder and stronger, throwing cold droplets up from the lake and into my face. One gust of wind brought me the sound of an airliner overhead, and another the lonely whistle of a freight train. Distantly, somewhere on the lake, a bell rang out several times, a solemn sound that made me think of a funeral dirge. Beyond that, nothing stirred. I waited. In time, the fire faded from the overcast sky, and only the darkest tones of purple were left on the western horizon behind me. Damn it. She wasn't coming. After I thought that, but before I could actually turn around, there was a swirling in the waters near my feet, and a slow spiral of water spray spun up from the surface of the lake. A bizarre sight. The spray rolled up and away from a female form, beginning at the feet, bare and pale, and rolling up over a medieval-style gown of emerald green. The gown was belted with a woven silver rope and a slightly curved, single-edged knife of some dark, glassy material hung at an angle through it. When the spray rolled up over the woman's face, I expected my godmother's blazing wealth of copper and scarlet curls, her wide feline eyes of amber, her features that always made her seem smug and somewhat pleased with herself, in absence of the animation of any other emotion. Instead,
I saw a long, pale throat, features of heart-stopping, cold beauty, canted eyes greener than any color to be found in the natural world, and long, silken hair of purest white, bound within a circlet of what looked like rose vines, surrounded in gleaming ice, beautiful and brittle and cruel. Behind me, a deep-throated snarl burst forth from Mouse back on the shore. "Greetings, mortal," said the fairy woman. Her voice shook water and earth and sky with subtle power. I felt it resonating through the elements around me as much as heard it. My mouth went dry and my throat got tight. I leaned on my staff to help me balance as I cast a courtly bow in her direction. "Greetings, Queen Mab. I do beg your pardon. It was not my intention to disturb thee." My head shifted into panicked, quick thought. Queen Mab had come to me, and that absolutely could not be good. Mab, monarch of the winter court of the Shi, the queen of air and darkness, was not a very nice person. In fact, she was one of the most feared beings of power you'd find short of archangels and ancient gods. I'd once used my wizard sight to look upon Mab as she unveiled her true self in a working of power, and it had come perilously close to driving me insane. Mab was not some paltry mortal being like Gravain or Cowl or the Corpse Taker. She was far older, far crueler, far more deadly than they could ever be. And I owed her a favor. Two, to be exact. She stared at me for a long and silent moment, and I didn't look at her face. Then she let out a quiet laugh and said, "Disturb me? Hardly. I am here only to fulfill the duties I have been obliged to take upon myself. It is no fault of thine that this summons reached mine ears." I straightened up slowly and avoided her eyes. "I had expected my godmother to come." Mab smiled. Her teeth were small and white and perfect, her canines delicately sharp. "Alas, the Lanonshi is tied up at the moment." I drew in a breath. My godmother was a powerful member of the Winter Court, but she couldn't hold a candle to Mab. If Mab wanted to take Leah down, she certainly could do it. And for some reason, the thought spurred on a protective instinct, something that made me irrationally angry. Yes, Leah was hardly a benevolent being in her own right. Yes, she'd tried to enslave me several times in the past several years. But for all of that, she was still my godmother, and the thought of something happening to her angered me. "For what reason have you detained her?" "Because I do not tolerate challenges to my authority," she said. One pale hand drifted to the hilt of the knife at her belt. "Certain events had convinced your godmother that she was no longer bound by my word and will. She is now learning otherwise." "What have you done to her?" I asked. Well, it didn't sound like a question so much as a demand. Mab laughed, and the sound of it came out silvery and smoother than honey. The laugh bounded around the waves and the earth and the winds, clashing against itself in a manner that made the hairs on my neck stand up and my heart race with a sudden apprehension, as I felt an odd kind of pressure settle over me, as if I were closed into a small room. I gritted my teeth and waited the laugh out, trying not to show how harshly it had affected me. "She is bound," Mab said. "She is in some discomfort, but she is in no danger from my hand. Once she acknowledges who rules Winter, she will be restored to her station. I can ill afford the loss of so potent a vassal." "I need to speak to her now," I said. "Of course," Mab said. "Yet she languishes in the process of enlightenment. Thus I am here to fulfill her obligation to teach and guide you." I frowned. "You locked her away somewhere, but you're keeping her promises?" Something cold and haughty flickered through Mab's eyes. "Promises must be kept," she murmured, and the words made wave, wind, and stone tremble.
My vassal's oaths and bargains are binding upon me, so long as I restrain her from fulfilling them.
Does that mean that you will help me? I asked.
It means that I will give you what she might give you, Mab said, and speak what knowledge she might have spoken to you, were she here in flesh, rather than in proxy. She tilted her head slowly to one side.
You know, wizard, that I may speak no word that is untrue. Thus is my word given to you.
I eyed her warily. It was true that the High She could not speak words that were untrue, but that wasn't the same thing as telling the truth. Most of the She I had met were past masters of the art of deception, speaking in allusions and riddles and inferences that would undermine the necessary honesty of their words so thoroughly that they might be much stronger lies than if they had simply spoken a direct falsehood. Trusting the word of one of the She was an enterprise best undertaken with extraordinary caution and exacting care. If I had any choice in the matter, I would avoid it. But there was nothing I could do but forge ahead. I still had to find out more about what Sergeant Kemmler's Lonely Hearts Club band was doing in Chicago, and that meant taking the risk of speaking with my godmother. Mab was simply more of the same risk. A lot more of it. I seek knowledge, I said, about the one known as the Earl King. Mab arched an eyebrow.
Him? She said. Yes, your godmother knows some little of him. What would you know of him?
I want to know why all of Kemmler's disciples are grabbing up all the copies of the White Council's book about him. Nothing that I could imagine would truly rattle Mab's composure, but that sentence apparently came close. Her expression froze, and with it the wind came to a sudden, dead halt. The waves of the shore abruptly stilled to a sheet of glass beneath her feet, dimly reflecting the glow of the city skyline in the distance and the last shreds of purple light in the leaden sky.
"Kemmler's disciples," she said. Her eyes were deeper than the lake she stood upon. "Could it be?"
"Could what be?" I asked.
"The word," she said. "The word of Kemmler. Has it been found?"
I said, "sort of." Her delicate white brows rose.
"Meaning what, pray tell?"
"Meaning that the book was found," I said, "by a local thief. He tried to sell it to a man named Gravain."
"Kemmler's first student," Mab said. "Did he acquire the book?"
"No," I said. "The thief used mortal technology to conceal the book, in order to prevent Gravain from taking it from him without paying."
"Gravain killed him," Mab guessed.
"And how?"
"This mortal ferromancy, technology, you called it, does it yet conceal the book?"
"Yeah."
"Gravain yet seeks it?"
"Yeah. Him and at least two more, Cowell and the corpse taker."
Mab lifted a pale hand and tapped a finger to rich, lovely lips the color of frozen mulberries. Her nails were colored with shining opalescence, gorgeous to the eye and distracting as hell. I felt a little dizzy until I forced myself not to look at them. "Dangerous," she mused. "You have fallen among deadly company, mortal. Even the council fears them."
"You don't say."
Mab narrowed her eyes, and a little smile graced her lips. "Impudent," she said. "It's sweet on you."
"Gosh, that's flattering," I said. "But you haven't told me a thing about why they might be interested in the Earl King."
Mab pursed her lips. "The being you ask me about is to goblins as I am to the She, a ruler, a master of their kind, devious, cunning, strong, and swift. He wields dominion over the spirits of fallen hunters."
I frowned.
"What kind of spirits?"
"The spirits of those who hunt," Mab said. "The energy of the hunt, of excitement, hunger, bloodlust. Betimes the Earl King will call those spirits into the form of the great black hounds and ride the winds and forests as the wild hunt. He carries great power with him as he does,
power that calls to the remnants of hunters now passed on from mortal life.
You're talking about ghosts, I said, the spirit of hunters.
Indeed, Mab said, shades that lay in quiet rest beyond the beck of the mortal pale will rise up to the night and the stars at the sound of his horn and join the hunt.
Powerful shades, I said quietly.
Spectres most potent, Mab said, nodding, her eyes bright and almost merry as they watched me.
I leaned on my staff, trying to get as much weight as I could off of my injured leg, so that it would stop pounding enough to make me think.
So a gaggle of wizards whose stock in trade is enslaving the dead to their will is interested in a being whose presence calls up powerful spirits they couldn't otherwise reach.
I followed the chain of logic from there.
There's something in the book that tells them how to get his attention.
Darling child, Mab said. So clever for one so young.
So what is it, I asked. Which part of the book?
Your godmother, she said, her smile growing wider, has no idea.
I ground my teeth together. But you do?
I am the queen of air and darkness, wizard. There is little I do not.
Will you tell me?
She touched the tip of her tongue to her lips, as if savoring the taste of the words.
You should know us better than that by now, wizard. Nothing given by one of the she comes without a price.
My foot hurt. I had to hop a little bit on my good leg when my balance wavered.
Great, I muttered. What is it you want?
You, Mav said, folding her hands primly in front of her. My offer of knighthood yet stands open to you.
What's wrong with the new guy, I asked, that you dump him for me?
Mab showed me her teeth again. I have not yet replaced my current knight, treacherous though he is, she purred.
He's still alive? I asked.
I suppose, Mab said, though he very much wishes that he were not. I have taken the time to explain to him at length the error of his ways.
Torture. She'd been torturing him in vengeance for his treachery for more than 3 years. I felt a little sick to my stomach.
If you like, you might consider it an act of mercy, she said. Accept my offer, and I will forgive your debt to me and answer all your questions freely.
I shuddered. Mab's last knight had been an abusive, psychotic, drug-addicted, murdering rapist. I was never clear on whether he got the job because of those qualities, or whether they had been instilled in him on the job. Either way, the title of Winter Knight was a permanent gig. If I accepted Mab's offer, I'd be doing it for life. Though there would, of course, be no promises as to how long that life would be.
I told you once before, I said, that I'm not interested.
Things have changed, wizard, Mab said. You know the kind of power you face in Kemler's heirs.
As the Winter Knight, you would have strength far outweighing even your own considerable gifts. You would have the wherewithal to face your foes, rather than slinking through the night, gathering up whispers to use against them.
No, I paused, and then said, and no means no.
Mab shrugged one shoulder, a liquid motion that drew my eyes toward the curves of her breasts within the silken gown.
You disappoint me, child, but I can wait. I can wait until the sun burns cold.
Thunder rumbled over the lake. Off in the southwest, lightning leapt from cloud to cloud.
Mab turned her head to watch.
Interesting.
What's interesting?
Powers at work, preparing the way.
What is that supposed to mean? I asked.
That you have little time, Mab said.
She turned to face me again.
I must do what I might to preserve your life. Know this, mortal. Should Kemler's heirs acquire the knowledge bound within the word, they will be in a position to gather up such power as the world has not seen in many thousands of years.
What?
How?
Kemmler was, Mab's eyes grew distant as if in memory, a madman, a monster, but brilliant. He learned how to bind to his will not only dead flesh, but shades, to rend them asunder and devour them to feed his own power. It was the secret of the strength that allowed him to defy all the White Council together. I added 2 and 2 and got 4.
The heirs want to call up the ancient spirits, I breathed, and then devour them for power.
Mab's deep green eyes almost seemed to glow with intensity. Kemmler himself attempted it, but the council struck him down before he could finish. I swallowed.
What happens if one of his heirs is able to do it?
The heir would gain power such as not been wielded by mortal hands in the memory of your race, Mab said.
The Dark Hallow, I said. I rubbed at my eyes. That's what it is. A ritual, tomorrow night, Halloween. They all want to be the one to make themselves into a junior league god.
Power is ever sweet, is it not? I thought about it some more. I had to worry about more than just Kemmler's cronies. Mavra wanted the word, too.
Hell's bells. If Mavra succeeded in making herself into some kind of dark goddess, there wasn't a chance in hell that she wouldn't obliterate me at the first opportunity.
Can they do it without the word?
Mab's mouth curled up in a slow smile.
If they could, why would they seek it so desperately?
The wind began to stir again, and the lake began to resume its ebb and flow.
Beware, wizard. You are engaged in a most deadly game. I should be disappointed were I deprived of your service.
Then get used to it, I said. I'm never going to be your knight.
Mab tilted back her head and let out that nerve-searing laughter again.
I have time, she said, and you mortals find life to be very sweet. 2 favors you yet owe me, and make no mistake, I will collect. One day, you will kneel at my feet.
The lake suddenly surged, dark waters whirling up in a snake-quick spiral, forming a waterspout that stretched from the lake's surface up out of sight into the darkness above me. The wind howled, driving my balance to one side so that my wounded leg buckled and I fell to one knee. Then, as suddenly as it began, the gale was gone. The lake was calm again. The wind sighed mournfully through tree branches sparsely covered in dead leaves. There was no sign of Mab.
I grimaced and struggled to my feet. I glanced back at Mouse, who was sitting on the shore, watching me with worried doggy eyes.
She always has to have the last word, I told him.
Mouse padded over to me, and I scratched his ears a couple of times while he snuffled at me. He looked warily out at the lake.
One problem at a time, I told him. We'll handle Mab later, somehow.
I walked back to the beetle more slowly than ever, and Mouse stayed within a step or two the entire time. The adrenaline faded and left me wearier than ever. I had to fight to stay awake all the way back to my place. A thin, cold, drizzling rain began to fall. I had just gotten home and out of the car when Mouse let out a warning snarl. I spun and wavered, then planted my staff hard on the ground to keep from falling over. Out of the darkness and rain, a dozen or more people suddenly loomed into view. All of them walked toward me, steady and unhurried. And all of them marched in step with one another. In the distance, I heard the low, rumbling thunder of a drum played on a big bass stereo. Behind the first group came another, and behind them another. By then, I could see the eyes of the nearest, empty, staring eyes in sunken, deathly faces. My heart lurched in sudden terror as the zombies closed in on me. I shambled down my stairs and tripped, stumbling against my door. I fumbled at my keys, frantically taking down my wards so that my own security spells didn't kill me on my way in. Mouse stayed at my back, continuous snarls bubbling from between his bared teeth.
"Thomas!"
I screamed.
"Thomas, open the door!"
I heard a noise, close, and spun around. Mindless faces appeared at the top of the stairs leading down to my apartment door, and Gravain's killing machines leapt down them, straight at me. Chapter 22. Mouse leapt into the air as the lead zombie flung itself at me and met it with an ugly sound of impact. The dog and the animate corpse dropped onto the stairs. The zombie swung an arm at Mouse, but the dog rolled, taking the blow on one slab of a shoulder, his snarl sharpening at the impact. The dog surged against the zombie's legs and got his teeth into the corpse's face. He shook his head violently, while the zombie stumbled and reeled under the ferocity of the attack. The second zombie bypassed the struggling pair, reaching out for me. I barely had time to brandish my staff at the creature and snarl,
"Forzari!"
Unseen force struck the zombie like an ocean wave, flinging it back up the stairs and out of sight. Mouse let out a shrieking sound of pain, ripped his fangs once more at the zombie's face, and pushed away from it. The zombie's face had been crushed and torn until it was unrecognizable. Both eyes had been torn out, and the undead thing flailed around wildly, striking blindly with heavy sweeps of its arms. Mouse leaned heavily against me, one paw held lifted from the ground, snarling. Three more zombies were already most of the way down the stairs, and there was no time to do anything but try my staff again. I raised it, but the nearest zombie was faster than I had guessed, and he batted the wood out of my hand. It smacked against the concrete wall of the stairwell and rebounded onto the blinded zombie out of my reach. The zombie snatched at my arm, and I barely avoided it. The door opened at my back, and Thomas called,
"Down!"
I dropped to the ground and did my best to haul Mouse down with me. There was a roar of thunder, and the leading zombie's head vanished into a spray of ugly, rotten gore. The remainder of the being thrashed for a second, and then fell drunkenly to one side, collapsing into immobility. Thomas stood in the doorway, dressed only in a pair of blue jeans. He held the sawed-off shotgun against his shoulder, and his eyes blazed with a cold, silver fury. He worked the pump on the gun and fired it three times more, destroying or driving back my nearest attackers for a moment. Then he seized the collar of my duster and dragged me forcibly into the apartment. Mouse came with us, and Thomas slammed the door shut.
"Get the locks," I told him.
He started shoving the door's two heavy security bolts shut while I crawled to the door, laid my hands against it, and with a whisper of will, rearmed the wards that protected the apartment. The air hummed with a low buzz as the wards snapped back up into place. Silence fell over the apartment.
"Okay," I said, panting. "That's it. Safe at home."
I looked around the apartment and spotted Butters hovering near the fireplace, poker in hand.
"You okay, man?"
"I guess so," Butters said.
He looked a little wild around the eyes.
"Are they gone?"
"If they aren't yet, they will be. We're safe."
"Are you sure?"
"Definitely," I said. "There's no way they're going to get in here."
The words were hardly off my lips when there was a thunder crack of sound and a heavy thump that knocked scores of books off my bookshelves and sent us all staggering around like the cast of the original Star Trek.
"What was that?"
Butters screamed.
"The wards," Thomas snapped.
"No," I said. "I mean, come on. Walking right into those wards is suicide." There was another clap of thunder, and the apartment shook again. A flash of bright blue light bathed the outside of the boarding house, and even reflected through the sunken windows near my apartment's ceiling. It was painfully bright.
"Can't commit suicide if you're already dead," Thomas said. "How many of those things were out there?"
I'm not sure," I said. "A lot?" Thomas swallowed, got the box of shells off the mantle, and started loading them into the shotgun.
"What happens if he just keeps throwing zombies at the wards?"
"I didn't build them to keep up a continuous discharge," I said. There was another roaring sound and another flash of light, but this time there was barely a tremor on the floor. "They're going to fade and collapse."
"How long?"
Thomas asked. There was a crackling buzz from outside, too slow this time to be heard only as a roar of noise. Blue-white light flickered dimly.
Not long. Damn it.
Oh, God, Butter said. Oh, God. Oh, God. What happens when the wards are gone?
I grunted. The door is made of steel. It will take them some time to get through it. And after that, there's the threshold. That should stop them, or at least slow them down. I raked my fingers over my hair. We've got to come up with something, fast.
What about the extra defenses? Thomas asked.
They're standing right outside, I said.
Hence the need for extra defenses, Thomas snapped.
He pumped around into the shotgun's chamber and slipped another into the extra slot in its clip.
Those defenses are meant to stop a magical assault, I said, not physical entry.
Will they keep the zombies out?
Butters asked. Yes, but they'll also keep us in.
What's so bad about that?
Butters asked. Nothing, I said, until Gravain sets the building on fire. Once they go up, I can't take them down again. We'll be trapped. I ground my teeth. We've got to get out of here.
But the zombies are out there, Butters said.
I'm not the only one who lives here, I said. If he burns down the house to get to me, people will die. Thomas, get dressed and get your shoes on. Butters, there's a ladder under that Navajo rug there. I want you to take a candle and go down it. There's a black nylon backpack on a table and a white skull on a wooden shelf. Put the skull in the backpack and bring it to me.
What?
Butters said.
Do it!
I snapped. Butters scurried over to the Navajo rug, found the trapdoor down to my lab, and grabbed a candle. He disappeared down the ladder. Thomas put the shotgun down and opened his trunk. It didn't take him long to get dressed in socks, black combat boots, a white t-shirt, a black leather jacket. Maybe it was part of his supernatural sex vampire powers, dressing quickly for a hasty getaway.
You see, he said while he dressed, about Butters.
Shut up, Thomas, I said.
What's the plan? He said.
I limped over to the phone and put it to my ear. Nothing.
They cut the phone.
We can't call for help, Thomas said.
Right. Only thing we can do is smash our way out to the car.
Thomas nodded his head with a jerk.
How you want to do it?
What do you think?
Big old wall of fire would do it. Cover our left flank and keep the bad guys off of us.
I'll take the right flank and shoot anything that moves.
Fire magic.
A sudden memory of my burned hand flashed through my head so intensely that I felt actual physical pain in the nerve endings that had been destroyed. I thought about what I would need to do to manage the wall Thomas had suggested, and at the mere thought, my stomach twisted in revulsion, and worse, with doubt. For magic to work, you have to believe in it. You have to believe that you can and should perform whatever action you had in mind, or you get Zippo. As my hand burned with phantom agony, I realized something I had not admitted, not even to myself. I wasn't sure I could use fire magic again. Ever. And if I tried and failed, it would only make it more difficult to focus my will on it again in the future. Each failure building a wall that would only grow more difficult to breach. My belief in my powers might never recover. I looked down at my maimed hand, and for just a second, I actually saw the blackened, cracked flesh, my fingers swollen, the whole of it seeping blood and fluid. A second passed, and there was only my hand in its leather glove again. And I knew that beneath the glove it was scarred in various shades of white and red and pink. I wasn't ready. God, even to save lives that included my own, I wasn't sure that I would be able to call up fire again. I stood there feeling helpless and angry and afraid and stupid, and most of all, ashamed. I shook my head at Thomas and avoided meeting his eyes while I gave him an excuse. I'm all but done, I said quietly. I've got to save whatever I have left to block Gervain if he throws power at us directly. I don't know how much I'm going to be able to do. He searched my expression for a second, frowning. Then he shrugged into the jacket, his face grim. He seized the saber in its scabbard and buckled it on with a worn leather belt. He settled it at his hip and picked up the shotgun again.
Guess it's up to me, then.
I nodded.
I'm not sure how hard I'll be able to push, he said quietly.
You handled Black Court vampires pretty well last year, I said.
I'd been feeding on Justine every day, he said. I had a lot to draw on. Now, he shook his head. Now I'm not sure.
We aren't exactly overstaffed here, Thomas.
He closed his eyes for a second and then nodded.
Right. Here's the plan. We get to the Beetle, we drive away.
And then what? Where do we go after that? He asked.
You don't see me nitpicking your plans, do you?
There was a sudden, heavy thump against the steel security door. It rattled in his frame. Bits of dust descended from my ceiling. Then another. And another. Gravain had thrown enough zombies at the wards to wear them out.
Thomas grimaced and looked at my leg.
Can you get up the stairs on your own?
I'll make it, I said. Butters came panting up the stepladder from the lab, his face pale. He wore my nylon pack, and I could see Bob the Skull making one side of it bulge a little.
Gun, I said to Thomas, and he handed me the shotgun.
Right. Here's how it works. We open the door, I gestured with the shotgun. I sweep it clear enough to get Thomas clear of the doorway. Then Thomas goes in front. Butters, I'm going to hand you the shotgun.
I don't like guns, Butters said.
You don't have to like it, I said. You just have to carry it. With my leg hurt, I can't get up the stairs without using my staff.
The steel door rattled again, the pace of the blows against it increasing.
Butters, I snapped.
Butters, you've got to take the gun when I hand it to you and follow Thomas, all right?
Yeah,
he said. Once we get up the stairs, Thomas runs interference while I start the car. Butters, you'll get in the back seat. Thomas gets in, and then we leave.
Butters said, Gravain trashed my car so I couldn't get away, remember? What if he's done the same thing to yours?
I stared at Butters for a second and tried not to show him how much that worried me.
Butters, Thomas said quietly, if we stay here, we're going to die.
But if they've destroyed the car,
Butters began,
we'll die, Thomas said. But we don't have a choice. Whether or not they've destroyed it, our only chance of getting out of this alive is to get to the Beetle and hope it runs.
The little guy got even paler, and then abruptly doubled over and staggered over to the wall beneath one of my high windows. He threw up. He straightened after a minute and leaned back against the wall, shaking.
I hate this,
he whispered and wiped his mouth.
I hate this. I want to go home. I want to wake up.
Get it together, Butters, I said, my voice tight. This isn't helping.
He let out a wild laugh.
Nothing I can do would help, Harry.
Butters, you've got to calm down.
Calm down?
He waved a shaking hand at the door.
They're going to kill us, just like Phil. They're going to kill us, and we're going to die. You, me, Thomas, we're all going to die.
I forgot my bad leg for a second, crossed the room to Butters, and seized him by the front of his shirt. I hauled up until his heels lifted off of the floor.
Listen to me, I snarled. We are not going to die.
Butters stared up at me, pale, his eyes terrified.
We're not?
No, and do you know why?
He shook his head.
Because Thomas is too pretty to die, and because I'm too stubborn to die.
I hauled on the shirt even harder.
And most of all, because tomorrow is Oktoberfest, Butters, and Polka will never die.
He blinked.
Polka will never die, I shouted at him. Say it.
He swallowed.
Polka will never die?
Again.
Polka will never die,
he stammered. I shook him a little.
Louder.
Polka? We'll never die,
he shrieked.
We're going to make it, I shouted.
Polka, we'll never die,
Butters screamed.
I can't believe I'm hearing this, Thomas muttered.
I shot my half-brother a warning look, released Butters, and said, get ready to open the door. Then the window, just over Butters' head, exploded into shards of broken glass. I felt a hot, stinging sensation on my nose. I stumbled, my wounded leg gave out, and I fell.
Butters shrieked.
I looked up in time to see dead gray fingers clutching the little guy by the hair. They hauled him off of his feet
and two more zombie hands latched onto him